First, then, came the priesthood, the temple system, which was the nucleus and the guiding intelligence about which the primitive civilizations grew. It was still in these later days a great power in the world, the chief repository of knowledge and tradition, an influence over the lives of everyone, and a binding force to hold the community together. But it was no longer all-powerful, because its nature made it conservative and inadaptable. It no longer monopolized knowledge or initiated fresh ideas. Learning had already leaked out to other less pledged and controlled people who thought for themselves. About the temple system were grouped its priests and priestesses, its scribes, its physicians, its magicians, its lay brethren, treasurers, managers, directors, and the like. It owned great properties and even hoarded huge treasures. Second, over against the priesthood, and originally arising out of it, was the court system, headed by a king, or a king of kings, who was, in later Assyria and Babylonia, a sort of captain and lay controller of affairs, and in Egypt a god-man, who had released himself from the control of his priests. About the monarch were accumulated his scribes, counselors, record-keepers, agents, captains, and guards. Many of his officials, particularly his provincial officials, had great subordinate establishments and were constantly tending to become independent. The nobility of the old river valley civilizations arose out of the court system. It was therefore a different thing in its origins from the nobility of the early Aryans, which was a republican nobility of elders and leading men. Third, at the base of the social pyramid was the large and most necessary class in the community, the tillers of the soil. Their status varied from age to age and in different lands. They were free peasants, paying taxes, or serfs of the god, or serfs or tenants of king or noble, or of a private owner, paying him a rent. In most cases, tax or rent was paid in produce. In the states of the river valleys, they were high cultivators, cultivating comparatively small holdings. They lived together for safety in villages and had a common interest in maintaining their irrigation channels and a sense of community in their village life. The cultivation of the soil is an exacting occupation. The seasons and the harvest sunsets won't wait for men. Children can be utilized at an early age, and so the cultivator class is generally a poorly educated, close-toiling class, superstitious by reason of ignorance and the uncertainty of the seasons, ill-informed and easily put upon. It's capable at times of great passive resistance, but it has no purpose in its round but crops and crops, to keep out of debt and hoard against bad times. So it has remained in our own days over the greater part of Europe and Asia. Fourth, differing widely in origin and quality from the tillers of the soil was the artisan class. At first this was probably in part a town slave class. In part it consisted of peasants who had specialized upon a craft. But in developing an art and mystery of its own, a technique that had to be learnt before it could be practiced, each sort of craft probably developed a certain independence and a certain sense of community of its own. The artisans were able to get together and discuss their affairs more readily than the toilers on the land, and they were able to form guilds to restrict output, maintain rates of pay, and protect their common interest. Fifth, as the power of the Babylonian rulers spread out beyond the original areas of good husbandry into grazing regions and less fertile districts, a class of herdsmen came into existence. In the case of Babylonia, these were nomadic Semites, the Bedouin, like the Bedouin of today. They probably grazed their flocks over great areas, much as the sheep ranchers of California do. They were paid and esteemed much more highly than the husbandmen. Sixth, the first merchants in the world were ship owners, like the people of Tyre and Knossos, or nomads who carried and traded goods as they wandered between one area of primitive civilization and another. In the Babylonian and Assyrian world, the traders were predominantly the Semitic Aramaeans, the ancestors of the modern Syrians. They became a distinct factor in the life of the community. They formed great households of their own. Usury developed largely in the last 1,000 years BC. Traders needed accommodation. Cultivators wished to anticipate their crops. Sais gives an account of the Babylonian banking house of Egebi, which lasted through several generations and outlived the Chaldean Empire. Seventh, a class of small retailers, one must suppose, came into existence with the complication of society during the later days of the first empires, but it wasn't probably of any great importance. Eighth, a growing class of independent property owners. Ninth, as the amenities of life increased, there grew up in the court, temples, and prosperous private houses a class of domestic servants, slaves, or freed slaves, or young peasants taken into the household. Tenth, gang workers. These were prisoners of war, or debt slaves, or impressed or deported men. 11th, mercenary soldiers. These were also often captives or impressed men. Sometimes they were enlisted from friendly foreign populations in which the military spirit still prevailed. And 12th, seamen. In modern political and economic discussions, we're apt to talk rather glibly of labor. Much has been made of the solidarity of labor and its sense of community. It's well to note that in these first civilizations, what we speak of as labor is represented by five distinct classes, dissimilar in origin, traditions, and outlook, namely classes 3, 4, 5, 9, 10, and the oar-tugging part of 12. The solidarity of labor is, we shall find when we come to study the mechanical revolution of the 19th century AD, a new idea and a new possibility in human affairs. Fifth, let's, before we leave this discussion of the social classes that were developing in these first civilizations, devote a little attention to their fixity. How far did they stand aloof from each other, and how far did they intermingle? So far as the classes we've counted as 9, 10, 11, and 12 go, the servants, the gang laborers and slaves, the gang soldiers, and, to a lesser extent, the sailors, or at any rate the galley rowers among the sailors, they were largely recruited classes. They didn't readily and easily form homes. They weren't distinctively breeding classes. They were probably replenished generation after generation by captives, by the failures of other classes, and especially from the failures of the class of small retailers, and by persuasion and impressment from among the cultivators. But so far as the sailors go, we have to distinguish between the mere rower and the navigating and ship-owning seamen of such ports as Tyre and Sidon. The ship-owners pass, no doubt, by insensible gradations into the mercantile class. But the navigators must have made a peculiar community in the great seaports, having homes there and handing on the secrets of seacraft to their sons. The eighth class, we've distinguished, was certainly a precarious class, continually increased by the accession of the heirs and dependents, the widows and retired members of the wealthy and powerful, and continually diminished by the deaths or speculative losses of these people and the dispersal of their properties. The priests and priestesses, too, so far as all this world west of India went, weren't a very reproductive class. Many priesthoods were celibate, and that class, too, may also be counted as a recruited class. Nor are servants, as a rule, reproductive. They live in the households of other people. They don't have households and rear large families of their own. This leaves us as the really vital classes of the ancient civilized community, A, the royal and aristocratic class, officials, military officers, and the like, B, the mercantile class, C, the town artisans, D, the cultivators of the soil, and E, the herdsmen.